Ladder Down the Sky by Robert Bates. We all knew now that some of us might never get down the mountain alive. Each had long recognized the near impossibility of evacuating an injured man from the upper ledges of K2. We had told one another that if somebody broke a leg, you could never get him down the mountain. But now that we were faced with Gilkey's helplessness, we realized that we had to get him down. We didn't know how, but we knew that we had to do it. Schoening in particular, and also Bob Craig and Dee Molinar, had done a lot of mountain rescue work, and the rest of us placed great confidence in their faith that somehow we could get our casualty to base camp. Gilkey's high morale and his confidence in us was a great boost to our spirits, and we faced the job ahead with strong determination. When on the morning of August the 10th, Charlie Houston thrust his shoulders through the tunnel entrance of the tent where Schoening, Streather, and I, shoulder-rubbing shoulder, had tossed during the long night hours, we spoke almost in unison. "How is he?" "We've got to take him down," said the doctor. "His other leg has a clot now, and he just can't last long here." The wind was hammering the tent fabric so hard that we had to yell at one another. Drifts of fine powder snow were sifting in through a strained seam in the tent vestibule, though we'd done our best to keep the shelter airtight, and we could feel the whole tent vibrate as gusts stretched the fabric to the utmost. "What? Move in this storm?" said someone. "We've got to," said Houston. "He'll soon be dead if we don't get him down." Nothing needed saying after that, for we knew what this decision meant. All of us had fought mountain storms before, but we had never seen anything like the duration and violence of this furious wind and snow that was still battering us. We all knew the story of the storm on Nanga Parbat, when 9 members of a German expedition had died of exhaustion while battling the wind and snow. Willy Merkel, Uli Wieland, and Willy Welzenbach had been famous mountaineers, but a storm had exhausted them and killed them one by one. Here on K2, we had not only the storm to fight, but the steepest part of the mountain, and we were trying to bring down these precipitous slopes a crippled companion as well. We all realized that our adventure had now become grim, for the odds against getting Art down were obvious, and our own position was getting more critical all the time. While Houston and Schoening were easing Art out of his tent into the storm, the rest of us began packing light loads to take down. We would need one tent in case of emergency, and we took the Jerry tent, our lightest one. We also might need a stove and pot and some meat bars, chocolate, or quick energy food that needed no cooking. Often the effects of altitude so weakens one's determination that doing nothing becomes a positive pleasure. But this was no time for lethargy, and as we moved purposefully out of the tents into the stinging blasts of snow, we knew that we had to move fast while fingers and toes still had feeling. Little was spoken. Each of us realized that he was beginning the most dangerous day's work of his lifetime. Gilkey seemed in no pain as we wrapped him in the smashed tent, put his feet in a rucksack, and tied nylon ropes to him in such a way that they cradled him. 4 ropes tied to this cradle could be held by 1 man ahead, 1 man behind, and 1 on either side. We had already put on all our warm clothing, sweaters, wool jackets, down jackets, and nylon parkas, and stripped our packs to the minimum. As we worked, the disabled man watched the preparation silently. He was an experienced mountaineer and realized what all of us were up against. But he knew also that we would never leave him, and that we would bring him down safely if it were humanly possible. Art's cap was pulled down over his face, which looked drawn and bluish gray, but he gave a wan smile when someone asked, "How's it going?" "Just fine," he would say, "just fine," and his mouth would smile. He never showed a moment's fear or the slightest lack of confidence, but he realized, of course, that he had been stricken by something that was likely to be fatal, that his condition was getting worse, and that he was 9,000 feet above base camp in a terrible monsoon storm, The nearest tent at Camp 6 was 2,000 feet below. He knew that we could not carry him down the tricky route we had come up, and that we must go only where we could lower him. Even in perfect weather, with all men in top physical condition, the task might prove impossible. Yet Art Gilkey could smile, and his smile gave us strength. While we were adjusting the tow ropes, Schooning and Molinar strapped on their crampons and disappeared into the storm. They were to find the best route past the dangerous avalanche slope that had blocked us a few days before, and to go over to the Camp 7 cache to get a climbing rope that was strung on the ice slope just above. It would be useful in the descent. After their departure, Houston called base camp on the walkie-talkie and told Ada Ulla our plans. "It's pretty desperate, Ada," he said grimly, "but we can't wait. We're starting down now. We'll call you at 3 o'clock. Each man took his place on a rope tied to Gilkey, and for a couple of hundred yards, we lunged hard at the tow ropes to pull Art through the knee-deep drifts of powder snow. Then gravity took over, and we had to hold back just as strongly to keep our helpless 185-pound load from plunging into the abyss. The steep slope we were on disappeared below us into nothingness. They continued descending. The wind and cold seeped insidiously through our layers of warm clothing, so that by the end of the third hour, none of us had feeling in his toes any longer, and grotesque icicles hung from our eyebrows, beards, and mustaches. Goggles froze over, and we continually raised them on our foreheads in order to see how to handle the rope. Moving the sick man was frightfully slow. We had to belay one another as well as Gilkey, and our numb fingers could not move quickly. Somehow, when we got to the steepest pitch, however, someone managed to tie two 120-foot nylon ropes together, and we started to lower Gilkey down, down in the only direction the slope would permit. Houston and I, braced on the storm-swept ridge, backs to the wind, could feel the terrible gusts trying to hurl us off the rocks. We could not see where we were lowering Art, but we could hear faint shouts from Schooning and Molinar, who were out of sight below. As we slowly paid out the coils of rope, thankful that they were of nylon and would not freeze in kinks, Bob Craig unroped from us and climbed down alongside the injured man to direct the descent. Soon he was completely obscured too, but Streeter climbed down to where he could see Craig's arm signals, yet still see us, and so we belayers had communication with Craig and Gilkey and knew whether to lower or to hold the rope. Alternatively, we anchored and paid out line until we were nearly frozen and our arms were strained, when Tony Streeter, whom we could barely see, turned and shouted, "Hold tight! They're being carried down in an avalanche!" We held. Our anchorage was good and the rope stretched taut. For a moment, snow flurries blotted out everything, and then we could hear a muffled shout from Streeter. "They're still there!" The rope had broken loose, a wind slab avalanche of powder snow that had roared down over both men, blotting them from sight. Craig clung to the rope to Gilkey and held onto it for his life. The pull of the hissing particles must have been terrible, but the avalanche was of unconsolidated snow. The falling powder slithered out of sight and down off the side of the mountain, where it must have kept falling long after we could hear it. When it was gone, Craig still clung to the rope, gray and very chilled. Both men were safe. The grim descent continued. All were cold and near exhaustion, and moving down over dangerous snow-covered ice stretched the men to the limit. They had to find shelter from the driving storm and food to renew their energy. Eventually, they spotted a tiny ledge. At that moment, what we had all been dreading occurred. Something threw Bell off balance, and he fell. I never saw him fall, but to my horror, I saw Streeter being dragged off the slope and making desperate efforts to jam the pick of his axe into the ice and stop. Streeter had been standing above the rope from Houston to me. In almost the same instant, I saw Houston swept off, and though I turned and lunged at the hard ice with the point of my axe, A terrible jerk ripped me from my hold and threw me backward, headfirst down the slope. This is it, I thought, as I landed heavily on my pack. There was nothing I could do now. We had done our best, but our best wasn't good enough. This was the end. Since nobody was on the rope with Houston and me, there was no one else to hold us, and I knew that nothing could stop us now. On the slope below, no rock jutted on which the rope between us could catch. Only thousands of feet of empty space separated us from the glacier below. It was like falling off a slanting Empire State Building, 6 times as high as the real one. Thrown violently backward with the hood of my down jacket jammed over my eyes, I had a feeling of unreality, of detachment. The future was beyond my control. All I knew was that I landed on my pack with great force, bouncing faster and faster, bumping over rocks in great thumps. The next bound I expected to take me over a cliff in a terrible drop that would finish it all. When, by a miracle, I stopped sliding. I was on my back with my hood over my eyes and my head a yard below my feet. My arms stretched over my head were so completely tangled with the taut rope that I could not loosen them. I was helpless, and when I tried to move, I realized that I was balanced on the crest of some rocks and that a change of position might throw me off the edge. The rope had apparently snagged on a projection, though how and where I couldn't imagine, but it might not be securely cored. Whether it was firmly held, whether anyone else was alive, I did not know, but I didn't need to wait. Almost immediately, I heard a groan coming from nearly on top of me. "Get me loose," I called, and immediately I felt the pressure of a leg braced against my shoulder and the rope was pulled off my arms. Bates discovered Molinar and Streether clinging to the rock. Below me, I heard a cry. "My hands are freezing." And looking down, to my amazement, I saw George Bell, who seconds before had been 60 feet above me. Now, about 60 feet below, he was climbing up over the edge of nothingness. He wore neither pack nor glasses and was staggering up over the steep rocks, obviously dazed, with his hands held out grotesquely in front of him. His mittens had been ripped off in the fall, and already the color of his hands had turned an ugly, fish-belly white. If his hands were badly frozen, of course, we might never be able to get him down off the mountain. Parts of the packing had been lost, and they did not know if the tent had survived the fall. They found Houston, unconscious at first, but later on able to move on. Miraculously, all five had survived the wild fall. They moved on. The wind and blowing snow were searing our faces. We were all near exhaustion and in danger of crippling frostbite. If we were to survive, we had to get shelter at once, or we would be so numbed by exposure that we could not protect ourselves. What had happened in the Nanga Parbat storm, which had taken so many men, was a grim reminder. Fortunately, the tent had not been in one of the lost packs, but as I started to unroll it, the wind threatened to sweep it off the mountain. Craig and I were trying to wrestle the corners of the tent into position when Streether, who had now anchored Gilkey with a second ice axe, joined us to help pin the flapping edges under loose rocks till we could get anchorage for the guy ropes. The slope was so steep that the outer third of the tent was off the ledge and overhanging, so that it was impossible to keep the wind from sucking under the tent and trying to tear it away. We were fortunate that this was our smallest 2-man tent, for it held the ledge better than a wider one. Actually, in Exeter before the expedition, we had thought it too small for 2 men and had almost failed to bring it. Pitching the tent was frustrating. For each time we would secure one corner, another corner would shudder loose. Finally, we tied the front guy rope to a rock piton and lashed the inside corners as well as we could to projecting rocks. When Bob Craig later pounded in a Bernays ice piton, we felt somewhat safer, though the nylon shroud line attached to it didn't look too strong, and the outer section of the tent bulged out over the slope. If someone inside forgot how precariously the tent was poised and leaned against the outer wall, we knew that the fabric would probably tear or the whole tent pull loose from the little ledge and, with everyone in it, roll down the mountain into space. The moment the bivouac tent was up, three of us prepared to go back for Art Gilkey. He was only 150 feet away, but a low rib of rock hid from sight the ice gully where we had left him, suspended from the two widely separated ice axes, each firmly thrust into the snow. Gilkey had called to us a couple of times while we were desperately hacking at the slope to make a platform for the bivouac tents, but the severity of the storm and the position of the gully made it impossible to distinguish words. Gilkey sounded as if he were shouting encouragement, but the wind blurred his words, as it must have muffled our answering shouts to him. He knew that we were making a shelter and would come for him as soon as we could. About 10 minutes after Gilkey's last shout, Streatha, Craig, and I roped up and began to cross the slope to reach the injured man and move him somehow to the ice ledge where we now had two small tents. We knew that moving him even this short distance would take every bit of strength we had left, and we roped together carefully and braced ourselves for the effort. We started out into the wind to traverse the slope to Art Gilkey. Streatha and I had had our snow glasses off most of the day because snow had frozen over the lenses, turning them almost to blinders. Apparently we had developed a touch of snow blindness because we now seemed to be seeing everything through a very light mist. This mist was hard to distinguish from blowing snow, and we seemed to be moving in a dream. Fortunately, the wind had dropped as we reached the rock rib and looked into the gully where Art had been left suspended. What we saw there I shall never forget. The whole slope was bare of life. Art Gilkey had gone. Our sick comrade, who had called to us a few minutes before, had disappeared. Even the two ice axes used to anchor him safely had been torn loose. The white, windswept ice against which he had been resting showed no sign that anyone had ever been there. It was as if the hand of God had swept him away. The shock stunned us. Blowing snow stung our faces as we silently stared and stared, but the slope remained empty. Something about it had changed, however, for there seemed to be a groove on the lower part of the slope that had not been there before. A snow or ice avalanche must have swept the sick man away scant minutes before we came to get him. As Craig and I belayed Streatha out onto the center of the gully, he looked down past his cramponed feet to where the slope disappeared into the storm below. We called and shouted, but all of us knew there would be no answer. Nobody could slide off that slope, out of sight, and remain alive. Dazed and incredulous, we turned and plodded back to the tents.